May it please the court.
You may proceed.
My name is Sean Honchin of the Blanton Law Firm in Sykeston, Missouri, and I represent the appellants in this matter, Paige Parr, Charles Parr, and Jeremy Moorhead, the members of the wrongful death class for the decedent, Kevin Parr. This is a co-employee liability case. It results from a single vehicle tractor-trailer accident that occurred on April 28, 2008. At that time, Mr. Parr turned over his tractor-trailer truck carrying 80,000 pounds of anhydrous ammonia and died as a result of the accident. It is the plaintiff's contention that Mr. Parr was not qualified pursuant to federal law to drive a tractor-trailer at the time of the accident, and that his supervisors, the respondents, Mr. Breeden, Ms. Buttry, and Ms. Cogdell, knew or certainly should have known that he was unsafe to operate a vehicle, but put him back out on the road anyway. The trial court in the Circuit Court in New Madrid County entered summary judgment without any explanation. It is my belief that the court entered summary judgment on the issue of duty, and that's primarily what I'd like to focus on today. We believe there was sufficient evidence in the record to support all four elements of a cause of action for negligence, and that the case should be remanded for trial. There are two primary duty issues in this case, the fund co-employee liability issue, and then some issues regarding evidence of duty and what can constitute evidence of duty. This case arose in 2008 and was filed prior to 2012, so it falls into the period where, according to the Western District's decisions in Robinson v. Hooker and Hansen v. Ritter, that the strict construction of the workers' compensation statute 287.120 and 287.800 require that co-employees can no longer be considered part of the definition of employer and thus are no longer immune from causes from negligence claims as to co-employees. Basically, and I think
you would agree that before that time, before 08 or 05, this court had held that they could be considered employers.
Yes, the appellate court decisions were a little scattered prior to 2005. The Gunnett case, which I believe is the case you're referring to, followed the more common law technique that you basically have a division of duties from the non-delegable duties of the employer and a personal duty of a co-employee. It's my belief that the common law controls in this case, and that this court should follow the reasoning of the Western District's decision in the Leeper versus Asmus case and find that this case must be tried. The reason is that you have to have a determination, and the court's jurisprudence going far back, including the Kelso case, states that the first issue is always whether the injury was caused by a breach of the employer's non-delegable duty or a breach of a personal duty of a co-employee. That's the benchmark. That's the place you have to start for all of these cases.
And you think that's a question of fact to be decided by the jury as opposed to what the Southern District here said was a question of law?
Yes, I believe it is a question of fact to be decided by the jury. The Kelso Court states that it's a fact-intensive question specific to the workplace. So you have to take into account that this is a workplace issue. And secondly,
So you would have us submit to the jury, what are the employer's non-delegable duties? I mean, how are you saying you submit that to the jury?
My belief, and I differ from the Leeper Court's footnote, is that the plaintiff is required to prove that it was a personal duty of a co-employee.
Why isn't that a question of law?
Well, under any set of facts, why isn't that a question of law? Kind of like probable cause. The jury can find facts, a judge can find facts, but wouldn't a judge be better equipped to determine the issue of what the duty is?
No, I do not believe so, because it's essentially a fact question to determine whether
you
caused
prove
the injury.
Well,
go ahead.
Okay, and the facts are found. Maybe you want to give the jury a special jury instruction to find the facts. Isn't the judge then still better equipped to apply those facts to the law
once
and make
the
legal
jury,
decision?
Once the jury determines which breach, or no breach, I guess, mm-hmm. caused the injury at issue, then the court applies. If the jury determines that, look, Mr. Parr's injury was caused by a breach of a non-delegable duty.
No, but see, that's our point, is the jury doesn't look at duty. Duty's a legal question. The jury would decide what caused it.
Exactly.
The court would decide what duty that breaches.
Yes. The jury would decide, and I think this would be, frankly, a very difficult thing to instruct a jury, but it's certainly not impossible, and I could give an example on a completely unrelated issue where we tried a case in federal court where the question was a question of law mixed with questions of fact. The court believed that it was required to submit this question of fact to the jury, that it was really a question of law, according to most Eighth Circuit case law, about whether a worker was a independent contractor or an employee. Well, the jury instruction ended up being, here are six factors that determine whether someone is an independent contractor or an employee. You, the jury, must weigh these six factors and determine one way or the other.
In Missouri, though, that would be a question for the court. Whether those six factors were present might be jury question.
But I think the jury question is, what caused the injury? And I think the jury has to determine what caused the injury, which conduct caused the injury.
Well, the preliminary question is the question of duty and what's an employer's non-delegable duty and what's a personal duty. What duty are you saying was breached here?
Well, I think when you...
I know you're characterizing it as personal, but what is the duty you say that they...
The duty they was breached? Established that the co-employees, Mr. Breeden, Ms. Buttrey, and Ms. Coggle, who all frankly admitted that they had the duty to make certain that every one of their drivers was safe to operate
and
a vehicle.
And out of what did that duty arise?
It arose under two areas. First, it arose under federal regulations, namely the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations, which specifically state that the employees and officers of a motor carrier are responsible and charged with the duty of making sure all of their drivers and all their vehicles.
So why didn't you sue every employee then of the company?
Only sued the three employees that had a role in making the decision to put Mr. Parr.
But you just said it's a violation for every employee, because every employee.
But every employee has that duty, but there are only three employees whose job, from what I could tell from their depositions and their job titles, who played a role in this. I'm not going to file suit against someone who...
And of course you're not, but I'm pointing out you're suggesting that because there's a federal regulation that says you have a duty to do that, and that creates their duty and they can be liable for violating it, is too broad because it would include every employee. You're tying it to these people who have supervisory roles.
Yes,
so it really arises out of their job. And why isn't that the employer's non-delegable duty?
Well, because there's a great deal of Missouri case law dating from a very long time ago that states that when a co-employee violates a personal duty when he or she orders another employee to perform tasks that he or she knows to be hazardous.
No, but what if it's part of their job? What if it's a non-delegable duty of the employer in this instance not to put someone out on the road when they're not fit to drive? How does it become a personal duty? If all he's doing is carrying out that non-delegable duty, and under Hansen it says he does that negligently by not adequately realizing this person was not fit to drive, why isn't that part of the non-delegable duty of the employer?
Because I believe that the federal statutes make it the duty of the employee, or not the federal statutes, excuse me, the federal regulations make it the duty of the employee. And secondly, Missouri case law makes it the duty of a co-employee to another that whenever they have knowledge that a task they are ordering a co-employee to accomplish is dangerous, that violates a personal duty.
Even when it's what the employer told them to do?
Yes.
So what cases do you have for that?
McCarver versus St. Joseph Lead Company, Jewell versus Kansas City Bolton Nut Company, Grazak v. the City of St. Louis. These are actually much better explained in Michael Manner's brief in the case you all are going to be hearing following this, the amicus brief filed by MATA.
And you can presume we've read everything in
both
cases.
Yes, and those cases make very clear that the personal duty can simply be greater knowledge, or you had a duty to make sure that what you're ordering someone to do is safe and not hazardous. And if you know it's hazardous or should know it's hazardous, which is my contention in this case, that they should have known based on the accident that occurred on April 11th, 2008, 17 days prior to the fatal accident, that they should have known that there was a problem with this driver that should have led them to at least do something to inquire about, was he, about whether he was safe to operate, rather than just ignore it, put him back out on the road, and suffer a fatal accident.
Wouldn't you concede that the employer also had that duty? Without regard to whether it was a personal duty for the co-employees, doesn't the employer have a duty to make sure that the drivers it puts on the road are safe to be there?
Well, that I think they do, except that the federal regulations also require that of the employee.
Well, but who else would do it if not the employees? I mean, the piece of paper in the Secretary of State's office can't do it.
I agree, but if the federal government felt the need to use the terms employees, they could have chosen not to use the terms employees and just said the federal motor carrier.
So you're asking us to create a private right of action under the Act for a violation of the Act? Otherwise, I'm not clear how regulation provides the basis for
suit. I'm not asking you to create a private right of action. I'm asking you to follow Missouri case law that says that federal regulations can provide evidence and standards of a duty one person owes to another. The courts have done it in regard to OSHA regulations and many
others. But if it's part of, I understand your argument, but if it's part of the employer's non-delegable duty to do that, then it's not an additional duty that the employee has. It's coexistent. Exists entirely, overlaps with the employer's non-delegable duty, and I'm not familiar with the case that would find liability and find a personal duty in that circumstance.
Well, I think that it is a personal duty under these cases that say that whenever you have that knowledge and you order someone to do a hazardous task, that violates a personal duty. I think that alone takes it outside of this, and frankly, all of these cases are exceedingly confusing because you have a workplace accident and because you can always argue that there was something unsafe in the workplace or else wouldn't have had an accident. Right. But the case, Missouri, like it or not, has always allowed these causes of action to go through, and you always have to make this determination, and it's never going to be a really simple, easy call. And I see that my time has expired.
Thank you, counsel. You have some more time on rebuttal.
May it please the court.
You may proceed.
While the analysis to determine whether a co-employee owes a fellow employee an independent duty of care under the common law has been expressed differently by Missouri courts, there's some universal constant principles recognized and accepted by the courts of this state when analyzing co-employee liability. That is, to establish common law negligence against a co-employee, a plaintiff must establish those same elements that are applicable to any negligence action, that a duty lies, that the defendant breached that duty, and that the breach proximately caused the damages. The existence of a duty owed by the co-employee is a threshold matter. If the co-employee owes no duty, then there can be no negligence. An employer under Missouri law owes its employees certain duties that are not delegable, duties relating to safety, as applied to the facts and circumstances, the allegations in this case, to provide a safe workplace, to provide competent employees that are medically capable and able to operate commercial vehicles, and to enforce safety rules. A co-employee can only be held liable where the defendant breached an independent duty that was personally owed to an injured employee. And a co-employee owes no independent duty to their fellow employees, as the Eastern District in Carmen put it and the Western District in Hansen v. Ritter put it. They owe no duty to their fellow employees to perform the employer's non-delegable duties because those duties necessarily derive from the master-servant employer-employee relationship and are not independent of it. Here, the appellant's allegations as asserted against the respondent co-employees are clearly stated in the second amended petition and defined as the defendants had a duty to provide a safe working environment to Kevin Parr, clearly a duty that squarely falls within those non-delegable duties that that have been recognized for decades as non-delegable and held.
But there are some unsafe situations at work that do give rise to an independent duty of the employee. For instance, in Hansen itself, it was where they jerry-rigged this, I think that was Hansen's elevator hoist case. That was something they said was created personal liability because it went beyond and created a risk that wasn't otherwise present.
It wasn't
Hansen. So it's not that every time there's an accident at work because it's unsafe, there's no co-employee liability. There are situations where a personal duty arises where what happened went outside the non-delegable duty of the employer. So
in those sorts of cases, and specifically the case that you're referencing, Your Honor, pertains to affirmative actions that were taken by a co-employee, a fellow employee, towards another employee where they rigged and hung an employee by a hoist over an elevator shaft. We're not dealing with comparable set of circumstances.
But we're not going to go back to misfeasance and nonfeasance. We got rid of that, really. So I understand affirmative act is normally how it's going to come up, but is it only an affirmative act that can be a personal duty, or is there more to it? When can a personal duty arise?
Right. I mean, it's when you're dealing with an activity that falls outside of the that isn't derived solely from the employer-employee relationship.
Are you aware of any Missouri Supreme Court cases that deal with the issue of safe workplace, which would be non-delegable, and then some additional statutory duty to also meet the employer's standard of care?
I'm not, and quite frankly, in reviewing cases from the state of Missouri and jurisdictions outside of this state and looking for some, any occasion that would support the appellant's proposition that federal regulations would otherwise bring, conduct that quite clearly falls within the non-delegable duties of an employee, would take it in some way, shape, or form outside of those duties or create independent duties. There simply is no support or authority to support that proposition. Rather, and I think it's quite clear from the appellant's brief and from the arguments that you've heard thus far here that the thrust of this notion that there is an independent duty held by the co-employees is based solely upon the notion that the suggestion that the regulations somehow create this duty. And that's a dangerous proposition and one that effectively does, in fact, create a private cause of action.
Are there other cases that have a circumstance where there is a regulation or statute that imposes an individual duty where the courts have found that does not create this independent duty?
I'm not familiar with I don't know the answer to that. I'm not familiar with it.
Counsel, why isn't this case governed by Badami and Taylor and Burns and the 50 years of cases that we've had on co-employee liability? Why all of a sudden now are we re-deciding these issues?
That's a very good question and one that I don't have an answer to, and I'm puzzled that we are. I think the decades-old precedent is just that the analysis by this court in Taylor in 2002, by this court in Tauscher in 1993, both suggest that there has to be an affirmative act and that taken to impose a personal independent duty upon an employee. To Badami, the Eastern District, and Gunnett, which analyzed the common law and went back to before the work comp laws were in effect, analyzed the common law, concluded that the something more test was in fact appropriate and proper to apply in these contexts. So I think you're absolutely right that we've had a structure in place for decades that requires a showing of an independent personal duty outside of the non-delegable duties, and that the facts of this case clearly fall outside of the duties outlined in those decisions.
Well, did something change in the statute that caused the courts to go this new way?
I mean, Leeper suggests that the 2005 amendments altered the construction.
And Robinson does, but I'm wondering, Baldami in some cases after it talked about immunity for the first time, but if you look at the statute, it doesn't say employees are covered. It's always said employers are covered. But the common law has always said, to the extent the employee is carrying out the employer's non-delegable duty, you treat him as an arm, as an alter ego of the employer, and they're not liable to third parties or to co-employees. And Valdami thought it was helpful to call that immunity. I'm not sure it's been helpful, as it turns out, over time. But liberal or strict construction can't put words in the statute that aren't there or take them out if they are there. So how does liberal or strict construction affect, should it have affected, how we resolve this area of the law?
I agree it shouldn't. It doesn't and it should not. I think the common law, irrespective of liberal or strict construction of the statute, the common law has always been, dating back to Bender in 1925, that there's a requirement that there's some independent duty that has to be shown or evidenced in order to support a personal, you know, liability to the co-employee. So,
and whether you call it immunity or non-delegable duties, or immunity is easier to say, there does seem to be a difference between the parties here and in the other case and in the cases on what is an independent act. And do you have what something more is? Do you need to have something more, or do you need just to have it not be a non-delegable duty? Can you address that?
I think that they're separate analysis. The first inquiry is whether or not it falls under the umbrella of the non-delegable duties held by the employer. If there's a conclusion or determination that falls under that umbrella of falls outside of the umbrella of non-delegable duties, then you engage in an analysis of whether Vadami Court coined it something more, or whether you've coined it an affirmative act, or as the vendor.
Why does it need to be anything? If it's not part of the non-delegable duty, then
right.
then just normal negligence rules would apply, wouldn't they?
Well, and I think that underlies the notion that it simply isn't a black and white, issues to whether it falls within the non-delegable duties. I think here,
because that's a big question, what is that duty?
And certainly courts, you can review the decisions, and they certainly have struggled with how to characterize or phrase or.
And we might be having that discussion now, even if the legislature had never amended the statute to require strict construction. It seems to me like there's a little bit of a disconnect between whether or not the something more doctrine has been accurately stated or applied, and whether or not it's required for us to go back and re-decide some of the basic issues that those cases have decided.
And I think the thrust or the general tenet running through those decisions over the course of the many years is that there has to be something beyond simply the execution or performance of the employer's task or the something within the course and scope of the employer.
And I guess my concern is, isn't that question as easily resolved on the pleadings as it is at some sort of fact proceeding? In other words, I can understand how a particular claimant may be able to allege something that's outside the non-delegable duty, which would require a trial and a fact. But if they don't even allege anything, why isn't it appropriate for the court to make the decision based upon the pleadings, giving them all, assuming they're true, just like we would on any other motion to dismiss?
And I think that's appropriate and proper. In fact, you saw that from the Western District in Hansen, where the court reviewed the petition, determined that the allegations fell squarely within the non-delegable duties, and dismissed.
Okay. That being said, what has this claimant pled that is outside an employer's non-delegable duty?
Simply put, absolutely nothing. And when reviewing the allegations in the second amended petition, the allegations are, quote, defendants had a duty to provide a safe working environment to Kevin Parr, again, squarely within the non-delegable.
Well, the one thing they do allege is the regulation. As you point out, and they're saying that created an independent duty separate and apart from their duty as employees.
They don't allege, in a review of the petition, they do not allege that there was a duty imposed by any regulations or that the defendants breached that duty.
Even if they did, if it doesn't fall outside the employer's non-delegable duty under 2008, 2005, just dial the clock back as far as you want, how does that, how would that create a co-employee liability?
It doesn't. I mean, if the petition, if the claims of negligence or rather duty, are determined to fall within those non-delegable duties, it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't. That's the end of the claim. The claim no longer lies. There's no liability for co-employees.
Is it possible for the employer to have a duty to prevent this particular accident and for a co-employee to have a duty to prevent it that is personal and not part of the employer's duty?
I mean, I think that the general tenet or the theme that runs throughout this is if it's a duty that rests with the employer, then it's a matter that falls under the umbrella of work comp, law, and it's a matter to be handled and decided there.
In effect, what you're arguing is the regulation gives them that duty as an employee, so it's not an independent personal duty, it's a duty as an employee, which takes you back into the non-delegable duties.
Well, I'd submit that the regulations don't impose any duty upon the respondents at all whatsoever to take a step back from there. But yes, I mean, to the extent that it is that the regulations, that there's a suggestion that the regulations impose any sort of duty, which respondents suggest do not.
And so why don't they? Can you address that?
Sure. The regulations, firstly, regulations don't create duties. Duties is a matter of law to be determined by a court as a matter of law. Regulations don't create duties. They may help define the contours of a duty, but they don't create duties where duties don't otherwise exist.
Mm-hmm.
They're evidence of duties. They help to define the contours of a duty. They don't create a duty. And that's what the appellants here are seeking to do, to create a duty simply by virtue of relying upon these regulations. And it's quite clear. I mean, cases from jurisdictions throughout the country, including this state, quite clearly state that regulations do not.
So you're not disagreeing with them. The regulations can come in generally as evidence of a duty, but if there's not something else that creates it, it in and of itself can't create the duty. There must be something else too.
There has to be an existing underlying duty that gives rise, to liability. If there's a duty, then perhaps, regulations can be used to as evidence of the duty.
Well, in negligence per se cases, I mean, this is well-trod ground.
Right.
If you look at a regulation, you can determine that it imposes or describes a duty, but you have to decide that the person injured is within the cone of protection created by the regulation. Is there any, it seems to me that these regulations are to protect the public, the driving public, not the driver.
Right. And I think it's a remarkable expansion of the application of these regulations to suggest that they would apply under the circumstances of this case. And I think, as Your Honor noted, it's a remarkable proposition to suggest that the proposition advanced by the appellants that the regulations apply so to impose liability upon each and every employee of a trucking company such that if the appellant's proposition is to be believed and followed, each and every employee, no matter their position within an organization, in the event of a trucking accident, would be subject to liability in the event that the regulations were violated. That's a very dangerous expansion and application of the regulations, and I think it's contrary to those limitations that have been clearly delineated by Missouri common law. I'm just about out of time, so to wrap up, the respondents are respectfully requesting that the court affirm the judgment and order entered by the Southern District, finding in accordance with precedent that there was no independent or personal duty owed by the respondent county police in this matter. And I thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. To respond to a couple of the issues raised by the respondents, the appellants in their Second Amendment petition pleaded three separate duties. First was to provide a safe working environment to Mr. Parr. That we can concede is probably gone. The second was to monitor the physical condition of Kevin Parr to determine whether he was fit to drive a tractor trailer. And the third was to determine whether Mr. Parr was in compliance with federal motor carrier safety regulations.
Yeah, and out of what did the second and third duties arise is the question.
The personal duties owed by a co-employee to another when they have knowledge that some task is dangerous and they are ordering another employee to engage in a dangerous task.
The regulation, in other words.
The regulations and old Missouri common law case law dealing with workplace injuries and non-delegable duties and personal duties.
What in Missouri common law would say one employee always has a duty to see if another employee is fit for work, as opposed to carrying out your job as a supervisor to to make sure everybody.
I'm alleging that these fault, that the respondents were personally the supervisors.
And that was part of their duties as supervisors, I understand. But
and that
but
they
you've gotta,
knew or should have known that Mr. Parr was not safe to operate the vehicle, and by ordering him to operate the motor vehicle, the commercial motor vehicle, they placed him at risk of hazard of death that under Missouri law has been found to constitute a personal duty.
And that's where I'm not clear why, though, that because that was their job, that was their duty, the non-delegable duty of the employer, and their supervisor carrying it out,
too. In the McCarver case, the co-employee that was found to have violated a personal duty ordered his co-employee subordinate to knock a piece of lead out of the roof of a lead mine without, and the employee did it, mm-hmm. and the roof mine caved in and killed
right.
him.
Mm-hmm.
And the court held that the co-employee, as a supervisor, knew that there was a risk of harm mm-hmm. in ordering him to obey that, to engage in that task, and that is enough to create a personal duty under mm-hmm. Missouri's rubric of non-delegable duties versus personal duties. And to answer the court's earlier question, the purpose of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations is to minimize the dangers to the health of operators of commercial motor vehicles and other employees whose employment directly affects motor carrier safety. That's directly from the Congressional Purpose Statement from the statutes authorizing the promulgation of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations. So the purpose of the regulations is to protect the drivers. The purpose is not necessarily, it's also stated, to protect the public, but one of the purposes is to primarily protect drivers such as Mr. Parr. I am out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under submission.